Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. I'm reporting from San Francisco, but it's been quite a week. I spent the first half of the week in El Paso and in Ciudad Juarez, the most violent city on the planet, attending the conference dealing with the war on drugs, recognizing the 40-year anniversary of its existence, promulgated by one Richard M. Nixon. I'm in San Francisco attending the convention for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And we'll have much about that subject on this week's Century of Lies. But first up, let's go to El Paso and see what's going on with the cartels.
All right, I'm here with Craig Reinerman. I'm going to let him introduce himself further and tell us a little bit about the work he does.
I'm a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. I teach sociology and legal studies. And I've been involved on and off for, 30 years or so in doing research on drug issues, drug problems, drug policy.
Now, as I understand, you have gone to Europe, you've been in Amsterdam, you've observed the comparison, if you will, of what happened there through their policies, and perhaps you can do a comparison to what we've done here in America.
Well, let's see how to do this succinctly. I've lived in Amsterdam part of the year, every year, for the last almost 20 years. And their system works quite well. You can't jump to the inference that it would work exactly the same way here, but it's certainly worth a try, given all the extraordinary expense and the exceptional and consistent failure of U.S. drug policies. We've heard all about it at this conference. You can't dismiss it. It's the one place on the globe that's managed to, in effect, to say we will find room within existing UN drug treaties, international drug control laws, to do what we think is best for our society. And that included, beginning in 1976, with the decriminalization, de facto decriminalization of cannabis. And a few years after that, they developed a system of coffee shops, regulated sale, small amounts of cannabis products, hashish and marijuana, to adults. They quite tightly regulate it so that if a coffee shop is a nuisance to the neighbors or if anyone is detected selling anything other than cannabis, they are quickly closed down by the police. They have to meet all health and safety regulations. They are not allowed to advertise and promote their use of their product. But nonetheless, despite having several hundred of these coffee shops in a fairly small country, 200 of them now in Amsterdam alone, the percentage of the general population who use cannabis in the Netherlands is markedly lower than it is in the United States, where you can still go to prison for using it.
Now, we hear some comments made at this conference that, one, it's not going to be an overnight fix if we were to legalize, and secondarily, that the cartels are criminals and they'll just find some other crime to commit if we were to legalize it. Your thoughts in that regard?
Well, organized crime is going to be a problem anywhere you have any kind of lapse in the law and anywhere there's big money to be made. There are going to be people who try to get around it. Look what's happened on Wall Street. I mean, you could say that what the damage that they've done, the rape and pillage of America's pensioners, was all done quite legally, or most of it done quite legally. So the line between, criminal activity and non-criminal activity that's damaging is much blurrier than we like to think. To loop back to your point, are they going to find a way back in? Those people are going to be criminal no matter what. But you can use the law and public policy to minimize the damage and to assert some sort of regulatory control over it. So now the Dutch still haven't solved the problem, what they call the backdoor problem. And the way the Dutch parliamentarians describe it is it's perfectly legal for people to walk in the front door of a coffee shop and buy cannabis for their own personal use, but it's not legal for the person who owns the coffee shop to bring it in the back door. And so they'd strictly limit how much of a total supply you can have on hand and so forth. And even there, there are some people of large grow operations that are still illegal and criminalized. And the people who muscle in on that because it's so profitable are very often organized criminal organizations. So just as we saw in the United States with alcohol prohibition really created organized crime as we know it, so drug prohibition has helped to create another kind of organized crime, and these drug cartels that are wreaking havoc along the northern border with of Mexico's border with the United States. So it's not like this is a cure-all that solves all the problems automatically overnight, but there's way less problem with organized crime in the Netherlands than there is in the United States or Mexico, for that matter.
Okay, and a final question. I'm a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I speak to, you know, Lions Clubs, people 70, 80, 90 years old, and even they are starting to get it. One of the things I hear said at this conference is, you know, what is the answer? And I want to postulate that it is for people to stand up, speak about what they know, to alert their elected officials that they know the truth of this matter, and that it's okay to move from this center of gravity, if you will. Your thoughts on that? What will it take?
I think that's exactly right. That's very good advice. You could say it a number of different ways, but the idea it's paradoxical because we think of our political leaders as leaders, but on the issues that are the so-called third rail issues like drug control, you've had more or less a century, really two centuries if you count the temperance crusade against drink in the 19th century, 200 years of almost relentless propaganda demonizing these substances. And it gives them far more power than they actually have. So voters are scared. The politics of fear is a sort of vote-generating machine, really. So politicians are going to be loath to give that up. Nobody ever lost a vote or a dollar of campaign contributions by coming down tough on drugs. The only way that's going to change, and here the leaders really are the followers, is if their constituencies tell them, look, you're wrong about this drug policy stuff. There's no evidence supporting it anymore. And we want to tell you that we support some serious alternatives to that. And if politicians somehow start to get the message that it's safe to voice first criticism of the existing system and then begin to pose alternatives, and that they won't pay a political price for that, if the constituencies and the folks back home in their districts will persuade them that there'll be, in fact, a price to be paid if they don't support reform, at that point you'll start to see some politicians move. Before that, there's just too much in it for them. They got a scapegoat they can blame for all the other problems that they're not doing that well on. They got a ready-made issue that's going to sound like motherhood, apple pie, and baseball that they're going to be able to get votes on. And until the public, civil society, and their electors make it clear that not only is it safe to say the drug war isn't working and we need to try alternatives, but in fact, we will punish you electorally if you don't, at that point, you'll start to see the political leaders lead again.
All right, you are listening to the Cultural Baggage Show on the Drug Truth Network. We're tuning in to some interviews I conducted earlier this week at the Drug War Conference in El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. This conference was sponsored by University of Texas at El Paso, and our next guest is Director of Chicano Studies at that university.
Okay, I'm here with Dennis J. Bixler Marquez, Doctor and Director of Chicano Studies here at UTEP. Dennis, it has been a very productive, very informative conference thus far. What's your perception?
I'm very pleased with the conference. It's a very significant step, especially in the border community, to begin the dialogue on drug policy in the United States. The fact that the violence of the border is beginning to spill over, it makes it a wake-up call for the United States, and it has to come to grips with the effects of, you know, the war on drugs and the trafficking that it has on, and not only on those who participate, but on innocent civilians who are dying.
Now, it's often, well, heck, it's nearly always overlooked, the fact that in cities like Houston in the southeast part, there's a lot of Chicano gang warfare, if you will. A lot of people being shot to the dead late at night in apartments over squabbling over drug payments and so forth. And this may not be in under direct orders from the kingpins in Mexico, but fulfilling their obligations is part of it, right?
Oh, absolutely. These are terms that have been allocated like you would allocate a franchise, and these terms have to be defended over drugs or other issues as well. But your large cities often play a distribution role as well. And in fact, the distribution is under even greater control by the cartels.
Now, I heard one of the questions in one of the panels today said, where are the border czar? Where is the drug czar, who both had indicated they would be at this conference? Why do you think they did not show up?
I would assume that because it's indeed an initial step on the dialogue on drug policy, in which issues such as decriminalization were likely to be prominently featured, that they're afraid that the federal agencies which are in charge of the war on drugs would in fact be associated or be perceived as endorsing such a policy, hence their reticence to be part of that and be in many ways subject to questioning by the press, which is, you know, well represented in this particular conference.
Now, you and I had a rather lengthy discussion before we began this interview, and it's my contention that, you know, there is just no justification for this, to continue this drug war, when aspirin and Tylenol kill about as many people as these contaminated drugs made by cartels and sold by gangsters. What do you think is the logic? What is the glue that holds this all together for so long?
Well, there's certainly a fear element about what drugs do to a population, and concentrating only in certain types of drugs while ignoring others, some which have been legalized, such as alcohol, or others that are prescription or over-the-counter medications that are abused and have also a deleterious effect on the population. I think we're beginning to come to grips with how to, through this type of a dialogue at the conference, to properly evaluate and manage, if you please, the access to drugs in the country, so that it does not have the negative effect it's had so far on the population, the incarceration rates, the cost of the drugs in terms of not only the actual law enforcement expenditures, but then on the health side also has really skyrocketed, and those factors have to be addressed and considered in any future policies.
And as a gringo, I came to El Paso this morning and the newspaper is talking about the cartels are finding new ways to wage this drug war. It seems we've been doing the same thing for decades, expecting that one direction, that one initiative was going to get it done. But they're going to adapt, are they not, around our efforts just trying to stop them?
They're highly adaptive. Not only have they adapted in terms of location, moving from one part of the border to another, but also penetrating by air, so that wherever we marshal resources to stop the flow of drugs, they simply move their operations elsewhere. In the process, often affecting communities in other parts of the world, not only on the border, we see attempts now by underground, by air, by sea, for which we have not had sufficient resources to stop. And we also see, for example, the immigration flow affected. And that is, immigrants have now often been used, forced, conscripted, if you please, into becoming mules who carry drugs, and they're up front in case somebody's going to catch them. And while these used to be very much independent corridors of human flows, now they're pretty much been co-opted, if not appropriated, by the drug traffickers. So even someone just coming to the United States illegally faces a likelihood that they'll be somewhere along the line part of the drug trafficking, and not by choice.
I've even heard stories of one of the new maneuvers that the cartels do is to kidnap the wife and children of an individual in Mexico and say, drive this across the border if you want to see your family. It's barbaric, is it not?
Well, it certainly is, and there's even a category of people who are not aware they're carrying anything, that maybe went across to buy food or some other good, or, you know, obtain medical services, and drug traffickers putting something in the parking lots inside their cars, and then just waiting for them on this side to unload. So it's amazing that some of them have been caught, but you have to wonder how many people never even knew that they're actually smuggled something, because they were used as unwitting mules, and law enforcement has recognized that some of these people were used, that they were not part and parcel of the drug trafficking business. But there's some tremendously ingenious ways that people come up with to bypass, you know, our interdiction efforts.
Well, Dr. Bixley Marquez, I want to thank you and UT El Paso for the courage, the commitment, the intellect to put together this conference.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Body odor, headaches, thinning hairline, increased sex drive, depression, mood disturbances, agitation, high blood pressure, severe anxiety and rage, kidney or liver disease, suicidal thoughts, rape, murder, and war. Beware, nearly 50% of the Earth's population produces large amounts of this drug and seeks to inject it into the remaining population. Time's up. The answer, testosterone. It's in the bag.
All right, you are listening to the Cultural Baggage Program on the Drug Truth Network, Pacifica Radio, and on dozens of independent college and pirate stations all across North America. We're tuning in to the recent conference on the war on drugs held in El Paso and the most violent city in the world, Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
All right, I'm here with John Burnett of National Public Radio. John, you alluded to a couple of things today here at the conference that caught my ear. One is that we're all subject to what our editors want us to report on, right?
Yes and no. I mean, they come up with story ideas, and they have favorite attachments to story themes. Speaking personally, I'm a very independent reporter.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. But I guess the point is that in the main, reporters are kind of constrained on what they can focus upon. I mean, Terry Nelson presented some ideas that, you know, would cripple the cartels, but that's hardly ever even brought forward in most of the mainstream media. Your thoughts on that?
You know, I think there's something to that. I think sometimes it's hard to get out of kind of the known universe of story ideas and to question the fundamental groundwork of what is going on here, you know, to really go back and look at the forest instead of the trees, and, you know, what's going on with U.S. drug policy, and should we question this? And that might be scary for some Metro editors, but I can't tell you which ones.
Well, and just in the last week, The Observer, The New York Times, The Washington Post have all put some pretty powerful stories forward dealing with perhaps the need to end prohibition. Are we at a cusp? Is this a turning point?
No, I don't think it's a turning point. I think there's more openness to discuss a broader range of ideas, and that's a good thing, because that's what's supposed to happen in the First Amendment, in the marketplace of ideas, and that's part of what this conference is about. So I guess that's a good thing, that we can talk about this more, and that you're finding them, you know, from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and NPR, and on down. I wish more officials at the administration level were discussing it, too.
Well, I'm running a series called Throwing Down the Gauntlet, where I'm going after every elected official and every bureaucrat in my chain of command.
Chasing them.
Chasing them, and they all refuse. They are cowards in this regard. It makes me wonder if, you know, perhaps they're either...
Pragmatists, I think, more than cowards, because they know that this is a hammer that conservatives use in elections, that if you are soft on drugs, it's been that way for 30 years, there's going to be a conservative contender who's going to come after you and say, you know, you want to legalize pot, you want to peddle pot to our kids. I mean, that's like the easiest soundbite you can get. And so that's the reality of American politics.
Okay, we're here with Juan Carlos Hidalgo, who works with the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. Juan, we've been here in El Paso attending this drugs conference put on by UT El Paso. A lot of different agendas, a lot of different thoughts being put forward. What is your perception? What have you heard? Perhaps what do you agree or disagree with?
Well, many takes on the war on drugs. I think that there is a chair concern about the failure of the current U.S. approach to this war on drugs. A prohibition is sending people to jail because of consuming drugs or because of trafficking. And I think that that's a step in the right direction. We're finally having this discussion in the U.S. Certainly, it will take a lot of talk. It will take a lot of discussion to combine a common agenda and a common set of policies to in order to flexibilize drug policy in the United States. But I think I'm positive about the discussion. I'm positive about that. We're finally engaging each other and questioning openly the wisdom of this war on drugs.
And again, I mean, the representative from the DEA was talking about poison. He was talking about the need to continue down this same road. There are those who are firmly entrenched in maintaining this policy, but what is your thoughts? Is he being outgunned by the other participants?
Well, definitely. When you have a multi-billion dollar agency that is tasked with fighting something, with fighting drugs in this case, well, of course they want to continue the same policy, and of course they want to continue the same approach, because otherwise they will be out of jobs. I think that it was quite disappointing to listen to the representative from the DEA, the set of misleading approaches, the set of even lies that his presentation was based up on. It's unfortunate that the government, whereas it's the Obama administration or the Bush administration or all the previous administrations that have supported the war on drugs, it's unfortunate and discouraging that they don't want to listen and they seem to believe their own lies. But I think that as long as we continue creating, making noise, and we continue to challenge this policy, the war on drugs, they are going to have a tougher time defending the same old entire wisdom of the war on drugs.
I'm now with Superior Court Judge James P. Gray. Hello, sir.
Well, it's always nice to be back with you and to discuss these issues openly, honestly, fully, and to figure out what we can do to decrease the harm that will be present and will always be present as a result of these drugs being in our communities.
Yes, sir, and here we are a mile and a half away from barbarism, from murder on a daily basis down in Mexico. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, it's not barbarism, but it is the logical result of huge amounts of drug money and the corruption and the violence that they result in. And if you look at what's happening, it's our drug money that is doing it. And we are looking at the people of Mexico so arrogantly, so self-righteously, saying they should do more to resolve our drug problem. And it's really disgusting if you think of it in that way. And that's the way it should be thought of.
Yes, sir. This conference has impressed me with the openness, the free dialogue that discusses the ugly parameters of this situation. But what's missing are the borders are and the drugs are. I wonder why they're not here.
Well, that's always the case, because the government has instituted not only a prohibition on drugs, but more disgustingly a prohibition on discussion, they don't appear. I've been asked to be involved in numbers of debates, probably 15 in the last couple of years, and they simply cannot find anyone to take the other side, and they, to the degree that they will ask me if I know people that will take the other side and uphold our nation's present drug policy. It's a pretty sad situation when you can't find people in favor of the status quo that will actually discuss it in the light of day. Politicians are really good at followership. They will follow where the votes are. And many of my fellow judges, many of mayors, chiefs of police, city council people, etc., understand the drug issue just as much as I do, but as they tell me, and they're right, they need political cover. They need to be able to know that just because they talk sensibly, they will not be kicked out of office. So it's up to us to spread that word and to give them that political cover, and then we'll have them leading the charge for change.
You know, sir, the average individual is kind of constrained, if you will, by virtue of the fact that the tentacles of the drug war machine prevent them from speaking up at work or in church or at school or, in many situations they might run into. There's just no venue other than, I would surmise, contacting their elected officials. It's just time for them to do that, isn't it?
We have just listened to a really disturbing forum here in El Paso among the folks in the media who are saying that there's an enormous chilling effect, intimidation, because they get death threats, particularly in Mexico, but even to a lesser degree here in the United States. So they're concerned about violence against themselves, and they hear them say, I have a family. I'm really worried about the safety of my family. So these are things that we're so in trouble with because of, not because of drugs. It almost has nothing to do with drugs. It has everything to do with drug money, and that we can address because our country today is facing two problems, and they're severe problems. One is drugs, and I don't mean to minimize the drug problems, but the second is drug money, and that we really can virtually eliminate, and then we'll be far, far ahead of the game. At that point, then we can all put our heads together and our finances and address the drug problems.
Coming back to the thought, fear. People think that these criminals will just find another, better way to create their violence, but it doesn't mean we should just back away and give them this forever, right?
One thing that we need to focus on is that when we finally came to our senses and repealed alcohol prohibition, homicides went down the first year by 40%. And I'm convinced that the same phenomenon will occur when we finally come to our senses and repeal drug prohibition. Now, what are these people going to do? Are they going to go into the numbers rackets, the kidnapping business, prostitution? And those are pretty all well taken at the moment. But I heard one lady who's a friend of mine, actually, who's on her second marriage, and she came in with the best reason that I've ever heard not to repeal drug prohibition, which was she has two stepsons who are adults who are selling marijuana, and she's afraid that if we were to change away from this policy that they would come home and live with her. And I have no response for that. She's probably right.
Thank you, sir.
All right, be sure to join us on this week's Century of Lies. We'll have many guests from the convention of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws out in San Francisco, including an interview with Assemblyman Tom Aniano, who wants to legalize marijuana. And as always, I remind you, once again, that because of prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please, be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of Engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Tap dancing on the edge of cannabis.